I think as a society, we have long COVID. I think economically we have long COVID. I think conceptually we have long COVID. I think politically we have long COVID. Educationally, we definitely have long COVID in this country because we haven't actually recovered from that COVID lockdown and response in a way that many other countries have.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is Mike Grimshaw, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand. Mike writes and speaks about New Zealand history, economics, education, and culture. In particular, he asks critical questions about the future of the country, which faces economic stagnancy, political malaise, and perhaps most dangerously, a complacency with our lot at the bottom of the world. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cody. Thank you for having me on.
I've permanently left New Zealand twice now. The first time in 2013 and the second in 2023. Both times I felt this overwhelming sense of an escape from a gravitational black hole. I found myself building a new life in Asian megacities, surrounded by the lights and carnival of the future, a sense that I was going out into the real world where things actually happened. But balancing that idea, of course, is the Arcadian myth of what I left behind, home, the whenua, Turangawaewae, a place of standing. These dreams of the hills and rivers of Hawke's Bay still linger with me wherever I go. I'm reminded of To Kill a Mockingbird. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go, nothing to buy, and no money to buy it with. So before we undertake our stock take of New Zealand, Mike, I thought perhaps we could start with an introduction to your background and what New Zealand has come to mean for you, please.
Well, when I hear what you say, Cody, I'm reminded of something a very good master's student of mine, Charlotte Steele, wrote in her thesis about 20-odd years ago that landscape will not save us. And she was dealing with the questions of how we often think that the landscape in New Zealand is our great offering, but it doesn't seem to offer much for people to be able to live here, and it doesn't really offer much as a sense of purpose and meaning, apart from maybe to drag tourists down here, exchange it for tourist dollars, or a sense that we're lucky to live here despite everything else. My background, I'm a New Zealander. I was born here. My father was born here on one side. My grandfather came from England. On other sides, I go back to the 1860s in Auckland. Born in the North Island, spent, unfortunately, most of my life in the South Island. I'm in a type of internal exile, I would say, but that's where work and job and family take you. I am now a sociologist. I used to teach religious studies, and before that I was a historian. As my wife says, I'm an intellectual mongrel, and she means that positively most of the time, which means that I'm interested in most things. I've done a lot of work in New Zealand history, New Zealand culture, New Zealand society, New Zealand intellectual and religious thought, and now social thought, cultural thought, trying to make sense of what does it mean to find yourself here, what does it mean to live here, and how do others see us as well as how do we see ourselves. What I like about being a sociologist is what the great sociologist Bourdieu said, that the job of a sociologist is to ask the questions people would prefer probably not to be asked. We're not so good at necessarily giving answers, because if we gave the answers, then we'd probably think we're more something like an economist or a political scientist or something like that. As sociologists, what we do, we ask critical questions, and we throw them out there in many ways, not expecting everyone to take them up, but to try to ask the critical questions of how are we living, why are we living in this way, who's missing out, who's being included, what possibilities are there, rather than that reduction of thinking to the singular, which seems to be the New Zealand way in many ways. We know what it is, it's common sense, and that's it. And if you don't like it, either shut up or shift on out. And I don't think that's served us very well. New Zealand's been problematic economically, socially, politically, in many ways for over 50 years since we joined the common market in 73. But the problems were going well back before then. And what I find interesting is that there's very little work really still done on New Zealand by New Zealand thinkers, New Zealand writers, New Zealand academics. We tend to think, as Alan Curnow, the great New Zealand poet, said, that overseasia is where it all is. The real world is overseas. I think there's a real world here. I'm just trying to make sense of what it is, and I'm still going. So that's sort of a really broad background. I don't know if that's really what you're asking for, Cody, but I am of this place. I can be of no other place. I once concluded a review essay in The Listener about 20 years ago on that I'm a Pākehā because I live in a Māori country. And what I mean is that this is a land first named, first encountered, first lived in, and then as Pākehā, I come in over the top of that. How do we live here together, not against each other? But also, when I go overseas, I realise the extent to which I am a New Zealander, even though so much of my thinking has, from when I was very young, been framed by what also came in across the distance, whether it came in across via books or TV or music or films. And I still live in that tension between being here and what is also happening elsewhere in the world. And I think it's a common New Zealand experience. I mean, this is the other thing that I think we forget in New Zealand, that only 3% of the world live outside of where they were born globally. And so this New Zealand sense that we need to go, that people come here, we're not a normal country. And doesn't mean we're problematic, but we're not as normal as we might think we are or wish to be, because that then starts raising difficult questions for us.
Yeah, that's
a really long intro to very short, basic question.
No, this is good. I mean, this is what we're here for, Mike. And I think this you're sort of responding to maybe what I said with my introduction, that you know I left New Zealand, the Arcadian, the simple rural life of Hawke's Bay, which has this profound pull on people, this localism, this energy of home. It's a topic that, certainly for my creative practice, I've spent many years searching for outside of home, and a lot of my photographic work, some of my writing. I looking back now, I think it was asking that question of home and what home means. And, you know, our own stories as people who have come from far away, in a sense, these islands, these southern islands at the bottom of the world, what do they mean? And in particular, this this kind of cycle that I've gone through personally now a couple of times is of nostalgia, a return, a dismay, and then an eventual escape again. And this this tension that I feel with New Zealand as a place, and certainly coming back over the COVID years for about 3 years in total, and kind of being stuck there for a variety of reasons beyond my control, it was quite a fascinating experience to reconnect with home and to see it for what it is after having left. And something, I mean, talking of the New Zealanders, you know, this process of living abroad does make us question the nation and the idea of national identity somewhat. And I do sometimes see New Zealanders visiting Japan, where I live, and I can sometimes tell they have like the silver fern on their hat, they've got some New Zealand like t-shirt, some kind of artifact, a statement of self that is quite interesting, because you know I don't do that, I don't think, perhaps beyond my accent, which I can't really get away from. But who are the New Zealanders? You know, who are we as a people? Because I don't know if I know the answer to that question anymore, Mike.
I don't think we've ever really known that answer. I think we've been struggling with it. There was the great move in the 1930s into the early 40s of cultural nationalism amongst the writers, the poets, the artists of New Zealand, the Pākehā ones, trying to make a sense of, well, what does it mean to find yourself here? And then there was a really strange move just after that where there was a sense that perhaps we were pale-skinned Polynesians. We were the newest Polynesians coming down here. That quickly disappeared again. And then we have a sense of, well, we know we're not British. And that was confirmed for us when Britain just turned its back on us in 73 and said, actually, we're off to the common market. And we had to suddenly scrabble around to try and work out who and where we were. At the same time, we've had an ongoing influence of America on this country from the early 1920s onwards, at least, with the influence of especially cinema. New Zealand had a very high cinema attending population, and a lot of that was cinema, not just books or ideas. Popular culture, we grow up on the popular culture of elsewhere, and sometimes we make it our own and we do our own versions of it. And so being a New Zealander is a really interesting question, because what are the resources that we have to draw upon? I've just taught stage one class yesterday, which finished up with the rise of the Maori Renaissance and the Te Māori exhibition, and that question about, well, we only valued what was in it when it went overseas, and suddenly America and Germany and elsewhere said it was fantastic, and we thought, oh, well, if they think it's good, then we might think it's good. And then we came back and New Zealand started to engage with it. And then I put up Bob Rocky's famous cartoon from the MBR in 1984, which is called Te Pākehā, the gods and treasures of the Pākehā. And what's he got there? He's got the seaside batch. He's got the BMW, the microwave. Nothing of really that comes through here. And that was a really interesting cartoon, because that was published in the MBR. And he was raising that question of, well, what is Pākehā culture? What are the treasures and the taonga of Pākehā society that has developed here? And I asked my students, I said, well, here we are, 40-odd years on, what would you say? And a great silence came across the room, and some really puzzled faces, because they thought, well, what is it that we have? What do we have to draw upon? What do we have to locate ourselves upon? What do we know of what it means to wrestle with being here? And I think that's an ongoing question. And I think New Zealanders don't really like to have to wrestle with those big questions, because yes, then the loss or the lack starts to come out as well. We don't really know our own history. We don't know our artists. We don't know our writers. And so we tend to live imaginatively elsewhere. Our bodies are here, but our minds and our hopes and our dreams are often relocated somewhere else. And that's normal. I mean, we grow up knowing other places. I mean, first time I went to New York, I felt at home. Why? Because I'd seen so many films and TV series and read so many books and magazines in New York. And I was walking down through the streets of New York, thought, this feels like home, and yet it's not. Why is that? And this is, I think, a very common experience for New Zealanders.
Yeah. This idea of tension is very interesting to me. I've got Maori ancestry deep up the line somewhere, and I think we have been living through maybe a couple of decades of a clear attempt to delineate that from, you know, to peel that off from New Zealand and create it as an other. And that has maybe been to serve some political means, some political ends. But I'm often reminded of some of the early whalers or some of the early so-called Pākehā settlers who very quickly integrated, and whether they were felling kauri or doing something out on the land, they basically integrated into Maori culture. And that kind of idea of the white-skinned Polynesian really resonates with me, you know, growing up in Hawke's Bay. I mean, you can feel it, you know, there is like a vibe of the farmer, the rural man or woman who's effectively of the land. And New Zealand is such an integrated society. There's been so many intermarriages and all sorts of things that you can't really peel it off, I don't think, at least historically, for people whose families have been here for several generations. But more recently, there has been a project to say, well, are you tangata whenua or not? And that maybe seems to be an imported idea, or perhaps not. But I've always found that interesting, because I don't feel that same tension. And maybe this is just me being from Hawke's Bay of all places, but that's always sat with me, that if you find these old photos of the Kauri fellas or the Kauri gum diggers, you know, there's an integration there that speaks to the origins of the country, certainly the ethos, I would think, of the treaty as well, that, you know, we are here and we're all now of the land together.
Well, it depends who has the land. I think that's the real question. I mean, the dispossession of land from Māori is what has enabled the possession of land by Pākehā. And that's one of those tensions that we're still trying to resolve. The second thing is that New Zealand has been primarily an urban population for well over 100 years. I grew up in small towns. I was a kid in Queenstown in the early 70s, then a small town called Geraldine in the 1980s. We even briefly lived in Hastings for a wee while. Then I've lived in Dunedin and Wellington and around, and now I'm in Christchurch. I sit between that rural small town and the urban. And I can understand the pull of both. The notion of one people, one land, or two people, one land, sociologically always comes back to, but who has access to what land, and how was that land gained or lost, and what are the ongoing social, political, economic impacts of that? I mean, you can feel an emotive connection to land as Pākehā. I don't think anyone would deny that. And that can go back generations. But the connections to that land is a different one, I would suggest, from the one that Māori have, which is land as central component of identity over multiple generations. And that's an ongoing tension that all settler societies have. We are a settler society that at the same time is unsettled often by questions. And that's an ongoing tension I think we have. How do we get around that? I don't think we get around that easily. Was that idea imported? I don't think that the unsettling wasn't imported. It became as part of a recognition that there was an imbalance of resources, there was an imbalance of power, there was an imbalance of outcomes. And what gave rise in that? I mean, there were government, there was government legislation that enabled the government to take whatever Maori land it wanted. That right up into the 1960s, that was still happening. And I think this is one of the issues that we need to work out. How do we live together, recognizing that we've got a history which is often deeply problematic? And I think the more we can talk about our history, rather than put it over to one side, then we can start to engage how to live now and into the future, because societies aren't stable. And you're right, there is that intermingling, there is that intermixing that goes all the way back. And I think often on a personal level, there is intermingling and interpersonal relationships. But when it comes to questions of outcomes, when it comes to questions of resources, when it comes to questions of politics, suddenly those interpersonal, often within a family, within friendships, within communities, within workplaces, those issues start to then get frayed, because if we look at the outcomes haven't been probably as equitable or as balanced or as acknowledged as they should be. And I think that's an ongoing tension that I think we will have for quite a long time, because we often wish to believe that our history is over. But we carry our history with us. We carry our history within us. We carry our history within our institutions, within our governments, within our genes in that way, within our society. And so society itself is not a finished project. And I think that's what I find interesting about New Zealand, as if we feel as if the past is done and that is gone, that society is there, we've got a new society, we just now start again. We are always trying to live in many ways in the present into the future, rather than actually acknowledging the ongoing presence of the past there. I mean, you're talking about the influence of Hawke's Bay on you. That's the past that you carry with you wherever you go. Now, what was the access to Hawke's Bay for your family is one of those interesting questions. The question for Pākehā or all new settlers is, we come here for a better life. We came here for better material, for a better material life, but at the expense of whom? What have we gained in getting what Pākehā or other new settlers say, this is a better material life for us? But what have Māori lost in that transition, and why?
You mentioned earlier this idea of a search for identity in the 1930s, 1940s, and in an article you wrote for Plainsight, you quote the mid-century New Zealand poet and cultural critic Rex Fairbairn, who wrote in 1944, "We New Zealanders are a very complacent people, and we love flattery. We are passive, not active. We are acted upon. We are, to some extent, instruments used for purposes not our own. It is because we don't realize it that we are so complacent." And even in the 1940s, we were, as Fairbairn suggested, about 20 years behind England and America and 10 to 15 years behind Australia. I haven't been able to track down a copy of his original work, but certainly seeing your commentary on it, it seems very fascinating that now, many decades later, this is still highly relevant to the situation we experience today.
Yeah, and that's why I like Fairbairn. Fairbairn's another one who wrote from England in the 1930s. He wrote back to New Zealand saying he's lost amongst this English landscape, English trees. He wants to come back to New Zealand and let the Polynesian out in him out on the Rantan, he said. So he had this notion that he was somewhere, he was not an Englishman. He was a type of, I don't know, new Polynesian, he would say. And Fairbairn is asking really interesting questions, which is why I think we always need to go back to him. His answers are not always the ones we might necessarily want to have today. I mean, he was quite interested in Douglas Credit for a start. He was a sort of an early social creditor. There are some problematic attitudes he has, but his questions are the ones that we keep on coming back to. What does it mean to find yourself here? How do we make sense of it, especially when we are aware that elsewhere seems to be ahead of us in its culture, its society, its engagements, its possibilities. I mean, you're up in Japan in 2025, I'm down here in Christchurch in 2025. Your 2025 is probably quite different to the 2025 in New Zealand. When you came back to New Zealand in those years, did it feel like 2020 or 2019, where you had left?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, that experience. I undertook a photographic project when I was back in New Zealand, and this idea of the unchanging landscape of, you can go back to Wellington or Hastings and you can find artifacts from a much earlier time, but it's not that old either. It's not like right. Europe where you can find hundreds of years old, thousands of years old structures. It's maybe at the most 80 years, maybe 120 years. And so there's this kind of little bit of history and then this long dreaming, as the Aboriginals would talk about, you know, there's ancientness. And even for the Maori, though, it doesn't go back that far. And so we almost come back to this kind of ultimate Spinozian idea, this the forests and the kind of the jungle as primordial soup from which these dreams emerged. And there's something quite profound about that, I think, that there wasn't anyone around to witness it. And from that materiality, this certainly from my photography, this materiality of, say, the kauri tree or the totara as what we then built our houses with, and sort of that material was certainly a focus of mine. But this, like, simultaneous lack of history and then profound history was quite an interesting tension for me.
Yeah, I think it's very true. I mean, there's that great line from New Zealand poetry, "A land with too few lovers," trying to understand it and make it a friend. And I think it occurs, I've written about how it occurs in different ways in the two islands. I mean, the South Island looks inward and the North Island looks outward to the sea. So we've got these two islands. They're in many ways two quite different countries in themselves. And they operate in many ways as two quite distinct entities, two quite distinct countries. And there are different completely different landscapes, but also completely different cultures in many ways develop between the two countries within the one nation itself. And I think this is part of the tension that you don't, when you move between the the places in this country, you realise how different they are. I mean, if you go up to Auckland, it's the fourth most diverse city in the world. And when you're up there, yes, it's New Zealand, but it's a completely different New Zealand to the one when you move out of that and you go down south or you go into the provinces. Now, that's a common urban experience, but the distinction between the areas is quite intense, I think, in New Zealand. And then the question is, what do we have to draw upon to read being here? What do we have to draw upon to make sense of what it is to find yourself here? And we tell ourselves a lot of stories. This is the best country in the world to raise kids. Well, except if you look at all our child abuse statistics and our violence against them. So it's the best place in the country to raise certain kids who are lucky. It's a really good place to live, but if it's that good, then why are so many people leaving? Because of the cost of living, because of the limitation of opportunities. And so we tell two stories to ourselves. There's a utopian one and a dystopian one at the same time. And we're not very good at living in somewhere between a utopia and a dystopia, which is the everyday. And I think that's our tension. I mean, what is everyday life in New Zealand? Well, we tend to flip-flop between utopia and dystopia. And, I mean, if you look at our politics is always on one hand, whoever's in saying, this is the best, this is fantastic, this is the utopia. The other side saying, oh, no, it's horrific. You're causing a dystopia to occur, which is, in many ways, it's an exhausting place to be in that way because we're not very good at living where we are. We are always, in a sense, between a sort of ecstasy and despair. We could almost say it's a society that suffers an identity crisis in that way. And we go back and you look at the high rates of alcohol and drug abuse in this country, the long history of very high levels of mental health issues in this country, very high levels of suicide in this country. I mean, it's what Gordon McLachlan back in the 70s was critiquing in The Passionless People, that we have the story about ourselves, but underneath, there's something missing. And in many ways, what we're missing, I would say, is the ability to live in the everyday.
That's interesting. I feel like I want to reference Heidegger here and sort of this idea that we must ask the big questions, but we only have little answers. And this idea of being a design, you know, the life being in the world with a capital B as opposed to just existing. And I've noticed as well, when it comes to New Zealand poetry or these kind of cultural artifacts, there's this great empty void that I feel when it comes to that relationship with the land, because it is, although there are obviously poets and artists who have responded to what the land means to them, the vast majority of people live in a very functional kind of economic relationship to the land, and it doesn't have this mystical, perhaps spiritual quality that you do see in other places. And I had this experience in Thailand a couple of years ago when I went over for a business trip with the Thai embassy, sharing some of New Zealand's agriculture, you know, with some of my other work, some agri-tech systems with what's going with the people in Thailand. And we visited a farm that had the water buffalo, and the guy said, you know, there's special marks that they are looking out for in the slaughterhouses that signify that it's a special animal, a reincarnated animal. And there's a white mark that there was one animal he showed us who had a white mark on its head, and he said that it got spared from the slaughterhouse because they saw that. And I thought that was the most profound thing, that even though they have this mechanical farming system, these creatures are designed to be eaten, they're farmed to be eaten, when they see that spiritual mark, they still go and take the animal out and put it out in a special place. And I wonder, you know, that kind of relationship to nature and animals is not something I don't think exists for the everyday Kiwi, whether they're working in the farms or whether they work in the city. And that's kind of a poetry of being that is quite a profound idea to wrestle with. And I think maybe we try and bring it in from the Maori culture, but it's kind of hemmed in. It's in these little pockets where you might have some native bush, you might have some kind of taniwha or some kind of myth Whereas for the vast majority of people, land is this commodity, this kind of fetish for real estate, this kind of very contemporary now kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah, it's scenery at most. And scenery is a commodity to be bought and sold or to be transactionally encountered with. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, this is what Charles Brash was arguing back in the 1940s. And he was writing about this need to be able to live with the land, to find a place as Pākehā on and with the land, as meaning, as value, as locatedness. I mean, and he found it for himself in central Otago. He found it in the mountains of central Otago. He found it also in the poplar, which is really interesting. He thought the poplar as an introduced tree in that landscape spoke to him. Because his family, the Hallensteins family, were there in Queenstown from the 1860s. And so he had this connection into that land, and that was what Landfall as a journal of literature and culture was trying to engage with. What does it mean to find yourself here? What does it mean to try and make sense of it? In his first editorial, he was asking about how what type of Pākehā culture might evolve. And he said, well, if we look at Māori, I mean, what they were able to accomplish, I mean, for Pākehā, it always depends on the spiritual resources of the people. And he's not talking in explicitly religious terms. He's talking about an attitude of life, an attitude of being, in that sort of Heideggerian way, we could say. What does it mean to be thrown, I mean, in Heidegger's sense, I mean, what does it mean to be being thrown into the world and find yourself in this country?
You know, this idea of the chiefly trees, the kauri, the totara, and the rimu, I imagine adding the fourth to that, the poplar or the English oak, that is quite an interesting idea. I mean, alongside the great messengers of the tui and the fantail, maybe we can add the blackbird. And this kind of integration, I mean, certainly Christchurch, which is a city I've grown to love more and more, it is, in a sense, this kind of idyllic English town upon the plains of the South Island of New Zealand. And it's also not English, because it's not like anything in the UK. I've never even been to the UK, but my ancestor went back once upon a time, took one look around and realized why his ancestor had left. And so there's this kind of, hauntology. It's like an England that doesn't exist anymore. And
even in the 1930s, the poet and writer Darcy Creswell down here basically got run out of town for suggesting in the press that that Christchurch wasn't actually English. It was closer to a Midwest American city.
Okay.
And so there's always been this tension. I mean, what we did down here was create instant history on the swamp. I mean, we had neo-Gothic architecture, which was a fake medievalism, an imagined medievalism looking backwards in the midst of industrializing Britain. And what did we do? We came out here and we plonked it down as instant history on the swamp. And so we had a fake medievalism of the cathedral, of the art center, of what is now the art center, but was the university, of Christ College, of the museum. And this is the interesting thing down here. After the quakes, what have we built? Well, we've built back a city that is everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And so, I mean, you come to Christchurch now, the buildings don't say anything of being anywhere, most of them. They're of a non-place. I mean, what we've got is this garden city, this notion of this garden in the wilderness. But actually, if you look at tree cover, Christchurch is 13% tree cover. It's actually got the least tree cover of any city in the country.
Oh, really?
Interesting. Yeah, it really is. It's really interesting. And so we tell these mythologies to ourselves. I mean, all countries, all societies, all groupings have mythologies, the stories they live within. What's interesting is what the stories are that we tell each other. And I think and this is one of the big tensions of this country at the moment, is what are the stories we're telling each other? What are the stories we want to live within? Who's telling the stories? How do we, this is the question about what is our history going to be taught? this is the question about, well, what does it mean to be a New Zealander? What are our stories we live within? And I think your Derridean hauntology is a really good thing to throw in here, because we have this sort of this haunting of a past, but also this haunting of a possibility. What is it that we were, where did we go wrong? Why did we not end up what we thought we were going to end up being as a country, as a people? Why, given all that we see around us, are we not doing better? This is one of the big questions I think that we've got. Why in a country that on the face of it has so much to offer, do so many increasingly feel it has so little to offer for them that they feel they should leave? Now, I can understand why people would want to leave for economic reasons, for cultural reasons, for social reasons. That's part of it. But we have a disproportionate malaise, I would say, in this country, given the distances we have to go elsewhere. I mean, James K. Baxter talked about the oceanic desert that surrounded us. And I think that is part of it. We realize suddenly we are a long way from anywhere. And so we've had to try and do it ourselves, but we haven't really had the resources to do it properly, because we've also had to do it very quickly.
Well, again, coming back to Heidegger, and I think he might be quoting T.S. Eliot when he talks about, we are not what we should be, we're not what we could be. And I think this is really interesting, because maybe we could talk about education in a little bit, but certainly it took me leaving New Zealand to encounter a lot of the ideas that have formed my creative practice, and talking about cities, hauntology, this kind of lens of understanding symbols and meanings. I got exposed to a little bit of that in university, but it really took me going out to activate that latent seed that had been placed. And I do really see this lack of a poetic mode of communication within New Zealand as a major challenge, because it's quite hard to talk about the city with no history upon the swamp without someone telling you to fuck off. And that's like, certainly, I don't know if that's been your experience, but it's kind of like, you know, people get on with it. There's a pragmatism, and I think it is an honourable pragmatism that, you know, we've got a job to do. You know, roll up your sleeves, put on the gummies, and get to work. But at the same time, our English tradition certainly has that. Whether it's the Scottish Enlightenment, the Waverley, you know, whatever the history of the land is, you know, there's always been people coming along and really looking at that from a romantic kind of a poetic point of view. But in New Zealand, there is a history of poetry, but it's not something most people are aware of. And so what are your thoughts on that role of, say, the poetic, the cultural artifacts that help us, and the education required to kind of even know that they're out there?
It's a great loss, I think, because I think what culture, what poetry, what literature, what painting does, or even music, it helps ground you. It helps locate you. I mean, we grow up being grounded elsewhere through our cultural what we access in terms of culture. And then suddenly you realize there were people who were doing it here and trying to do it here. And how do we make sense of that attempt to do it here and communicate it? What does New Zealand sound like? I mean, that was one of the big questions someone like Lilburn was wrestling with. What does it mean to try to do something creatively down here? Well, this is what the cultural nationalists were doing in the Caxton crowd. And that was recognized over in Britain by people like John Learman, as they were doing something which hadn't been done elsewhere. They were trying to make sense of a different type of modernity down here. But then we've forgotten about that. My stage one class yesterday, hardly anyone had heard of Conor McCann.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And that's a common experience. I mean, people don't know about Conor McCann. I can remember 20 years ago, I had a class where I was talking about what I called Pākehā prophets. And I was talking about Alan Kernow. And the only person in a third year in honors class of about 15 who had heard of Curnow was someone who had gone to private school in England because that had been part of the English curriculum over there. The New Zealanders had never heard of Curnow. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have. I mean, if I went and said Fairburn to most people, they wouldn't know what is happening here. But then in a lot of areas, we're not very good at dealing with New Zealand history. We're not very good at teaching. I mean, New Zealand history courses tend to struggle in a lot of New Zealand universities. Trying to deal with New Zealand literature, New Zealand art, New Zealand culture, trying to talk just about New Zealand society and its history is problematic because we don't think it's real. We don't think it has an adequate history or, we could say sociologically, cultural capital to deem it worthy. Because what use is of it? It's not going to help me if I go overseas. And I think that's one of the big things, that we always look to overseas as to where the real is. And in many ways, this is the desert of the real in Zizekian terms. I mean, we are, this is the desert of the real down here. The real is seen as absent in that way. And yet, we know it's not. But it asks difficult questions of us. So we need to think about, well, what is it? Why don't we wish to engage with the poets? Why don't we wish to engage with the literature? Why don't we wish to engage with the artists? And the answer is because unless it's comforting, it raises too many difficult questions, and that when we don't like to deal with that question of feeling. Because that question of feeling means you've got to confront the self. And that means, what does it mean to find myself here? And I think for those who are born here, to find yourself here is a different question from those who chose to come here. Because suddenly you are aware of both possibility and limitation. And I think that's part of it, because we're aware of the possibility of elsewhere, and we look around, and what we tend to see is limitation, not possibility here.
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, my journey out of New Zealand has involved a lot of self-reflection. And, you know, I went to Queenstown actually for the first time this year in my entire life. My grandfather has never been to the South Island. There's this great, I want to say, you know, we shit on ourselves. Coming back to national character, you know, I think this is this is part of the package, but there is this sense that whatever is local is of less value. And I've always found it interesting. I've got, you know, a lot of friends from Asia, different parts of the world, who those were my people when I was back in Wellington over those 3 years of COVID and that. And their experience of New Zealand is vastly different. You know, they can't think of anything better than going for a road trip around the South Island, whereas I think that's the most horrendous thing in the world. They can't think of anything better than going to Rotorua and going to the hot springs. Whereas for me, that's torturous. And this kind of idea that I've had to learn to see what is actually beautiful and available and abundant around me, and see that through the haze of this complacency, this, I don't know what we call it, this negativity towards the self, in a sense. Because I think this is something you quote another, I believe it was an American anthropologist, I can't quite recall his name, talking in the 1950s about the way the New Zealanders kind of, they seek to sort of destroy themselves in a way because they're so friendly on the outside. And so all this anger or kind of energy that would, say in an American context, could be, you know, just be spoken, instead goes inward.
And there's this kind of... We turn on ourselves, and I think that's part of the self-destruct. Yeah, I've got that book just behind me. Yeah. And I think there's another thing. We don't read these accounts.
Yes.
I mean, that's something that I've always been very interested in, the sense of how the others have seen us, what has happened. That's my original historical training. And so I've always gone to the big book sales and gathered up these things that are gathering dust elsewhere, and nobody's ever gone and read them. But I think the other thing is to think about tourism. I mean, tourism is going to someone else's every day and seeing their every day as if it's exotic, as if it's different. I mean, what does it mean when you live in a tourist country like New Zealand? Well, you're almost wondering why this is just every day. And people are coming and say, wow, this is incredible, blah, 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 blah. And you're looking around going, yes, but you don't have to live here, you visit here. And I think this is an ongoing, this is one of the questions of modernity. What is, in modernity, we now have the everyday person tends to have a greater possibility to go to someone else's everyday. But how do we interpret it? And then we come back and we're like, well, how do we make sense of this? I mean, you talked about not coming down here. Fairbairn had gone to Britain. He'd gone to spent some time on Norfolk Island. But he didn't come down to the South Island until 1947. And when he came, he was it was seen as such an event that they did like a piss take, and they went out and they drove out and picked him up in the airport in this car and brought him in and ferried him around as if he was this great visiting potentate. Just as part of this, that sense that here he was, he had finally come down here. But I think for many people in New Zealand, I mean, what is in the South Island? I mean, it's tourists and here be dragons, basically. And it's like, why would you go down there? There's nothing here. I mean, I've done lots of road trips around New Zealand, especially when I was at university. We'd get in a big old car and we'd drive around. And I got to learn the country in that way. And I think that's the other thing. We're not very good at actually learning the country. And learning it takes time. And you think about how we drive, we tend to drive very fast from A to B to get from point A to B without actually looking about where we are. And I think it's the journeying around that enables you to get a sense of what this place is. But especially now, I mean, we tend to just want to get on a plane and fly over the top, which is understandable because it's a long, torturous and probably pretty dangerous and expensive way to go by land. But we don't have that, those narratives often built into us now of the travel, of going around, of traveling back and forth through the country and making sense of it, but also having it explained to you as you go through that there is a history here that you can access and what is happening here.
Mm.
And so we live very much on the surface. And I think that's what we lack is cultural depth.
What I want to reference, actually, I got this book from my grandfather, Steam, Steel and Splendor, about the old New Zealand railways. It's by David Leitch. And this is from like the early 90s. And in the preface, it talks about this book takes a journey back in time to the 1950s and 60s, a period that many readers probably regard as the good old days. Although some technologically refined comforts of today were absent, so too was much of the present-day malaise. Times were prosperous. Unemployment and its connected crimes were virtually nil. Social services functioned properly. There was a general sense that all was well. And, of course, for rail enthusiasts, steam was still prominent. And this is, of course, the New Zealand railways that were highly uneconomical. They didn't run on time. Nothing worked. And all of that, in a sense, got washed away with the neoliberal reforms of the 1980s, this kind of great modernization of the New Zealand economy. And so coming into the side of economics of kind of where we're at today, I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on that, because this was obviously before my time. But it seems as if there was a great turning with Fourth Labour, with the longer years with Roger Douglas. And in a sense that there was a disconnect that happened there from this this past of 1950s New Zealand, or not?
That past had already gone.
Okay.
That past had already declined. I mean, 73 is really the turning point.
Okay.
73, British entry to the common market, the oil shocks, and we started to have to work out who and where we were. We were struggling all the way through the 70s into the 80s. But 84 happened because in many ways it had to. I mean, I lived through 84. I mean, I was just too young to vote in 84. I was 17, last year of high school. But I lived through that transition. And the country opened up. The country opened up in incredible ways. There was possibilities. And yet there was great destruction at the same time. I think, I mean, the Maori unemployment rate went up to 27% over that time. Pākehā went up to 7. And so those are the things that we have to remember. But at the same time, it opened up the country and made it different. Now, I would trace a lot of that change back to the impact of the 81 Springbok tour, where the old New Zealand got challenged by a new emerging New Zealand who wanted different choices, different possibilities. a different country. And I think that laid the seeds for 84. But I wouldn't want to go back and live in the New Zealand pre-1984 because I remember what it was like. And I remember its great limitations and how the country was struggling. And if you go back and read about what was then, it was economically, it was a basket case. In many ways, we've gone into neoliberalism, but we haven't really done it properly as well. And I know that's a heretical thing to say, but I also wonder, well, we're caught between. And so we do it, in a sense, on the welfare state without doing it for opening up business in a way that is sustainable. I mean, it was meant to be the more markets option that was meant to deliver this great possibility. Well, it gave us more choice, but it didn't increase our productivity. It didn't increase our economic performance in the way that it should. And so we are continually in a long interregnum, I would say. We're in an interregnum and in between times in which 84 is still there, but I mean, every government since 84 has been neoliberal in different ways, but they haven't really understood neoliberalism. And we want choice. That's part of the agency, but we give some people more choice than others. But we also haven't seen the delivery that was promised of a more market system actually opening up and giving more choice to people. I mean, this was meant to give more choice to those without. That was part of the argument for neoliberalism, that there were those without. We give people more choice. We trust them to make choice. We facilitate that. And they will be able to make choices that are in their best interest. But what we didn't do was remove the frames that limited the choices for too many people. So we're neither or country at the moment. And I think this is where we are. We're stalled. We're permanently in second gear with the handbrake on.
Yeah. Well, you write in another article, New Zealand, the way we have it, you say one problem is that while we like to think we are a first world nation, in fact, like many developing nations, we rely heavily on agricultural commodities that face protectionist barriers in overseas markets. We're not very good at diversifying the economy. New Zealand is broken and struggling to develop as it should. And when I look at that project of neoliberalism, and there's a very good documentary you might know, it's called Revolution. Mm. It talks about the long years and Roger Douglas and the reforms that happened. I look at the footage of like Wellington, and there's another documentary called Hometown Boomtown, which talks about the developments of Wellington around about that same period. And you've got Sir Bob Jones, you've got Michael Fowler, these guys who are like, man, Wellington's going to be the new Manhattan. And they were building all the skyscrapers. And yet today, all of the Wellington that I know is from that period. Nothing new has been built. And there was this great celebration of this underground arcade that they built that took them like 5 years. And, here in Japan, it's a much bigger economy, but that stuff happens every day. And so I sometimes wonder if we had like this kind of good start and then it just sort of petered out in a classic Kiwi fashion. And here we are today where the pipes are broken. That is the meme, literally the pipes outside my old office on Featherston Street leaking out onto the street, the lifeblood of Waiora coming out and, spilling out onto the asphalt. And it's like somehow we're stuck between this presentism, which I think you write about quite a lot, that it's always the issue of the day. The government can't really see beyond the next polling period versus the long-term debt of having poor infrastructure. And then and also education, again, as you write about, that New Zealand's education system isn't preparing people to ask these questions. So there's a lot in there, but I guess what is the way forward if we also recognize that, the radical side of the New Zealand psyche is also kind of there. And I think this, I guess what I want to pose to you, Mike, this idea of complacency and then the knee-jerk reaction and the radical reform that New Zealand is also able to do. Is it important that we find a middle ground between those two, or how do you see it?
Yeah, I think it's a good way of putting it. We are complacent, and then we snap into action, and then we slip back to complacency again.
That's right. Yeah.
We sort of wake up, have a stagger, and do something. Something must be done. Let's do it now. Oh, that's a bit exhausting. Let's go. As a sort of longies cup of tea. Oh, let's go and have a cup of tea now.
Yeah.
And we'll have a few scones at the same time, and then we'll have a bit of a nap, and then, it's all okay. Oh, we've got to wake up again. And it's a bit like how we were talking earlier about the highs and the lows. And I think in many ways, New Zealand's a manic depressive country. We have big highs and then we have these lows, but we're not very balanced in between. And I think we suffer in a lot of ways from this. I mean, you're right about Wellington. I mean, I was lucky enough to live in Wellington in the mid-90s at that time when it was the last boom town, when it was a fantastic place to live, to be a younger person. But then it went into decline. There was a brief period when Christchurch was a great place in the late 80s. It felt like something new was taking off, and then it fell. And we had periods of negative growth in Christchurch before the quakes. I mean, what everyone forgets in Christchurch was that the centre of the town was dying before the quakes. It wasn't the quakes, in a sense, were meant to provide something new. Auckland goes through boom and bust. We're not really sure what we need, or we know what we need, but that takes a bit of effort and takes a bit of change, and it means that we have to become a different type of people, perhaps. And maybe that's a challenge for us. We have to take education seriously, and education seriously all the way back down to preschool. We have to live in a different way as a family. In a sense, we have to care for each other. And not just a sense that we live with each other, but we live for each other. We have to have a sense that it's worth planning for the future, and we have to invest in our infrastructure, not just put it off because, I don't want that, I want this over here at this stage. We have to have a politics that is actually talking about a nation as a project into the future, not just the best business case for where we are now for a certain group. And I think those are our tensions, where we've got a very limited horizon. We believe that managers, we don't like managerialism, but we have a huge amount of managerialism. We've got this sense that if we've got a problem, let's have a committee. And a committee is action. And this was being talked of by Bill Pearson back in the 1950s, the fretful sleepers, I mean, about the New Zealand character. We've got a problem, let's have a committee. The committee's decided, well, that's it. Rather than actually saying, well, actually, that's only the start of it. How do we then ensure that something happens? The big question for is really, do we like being a society here with other people? Or do we live with and for other people as well as for ourselves? Or do we tend to live primarily for ourselves in a very transactional way with other people? And that goes back to that underlying question of, well, what's the purpose? What's the meaning of being a New Zealander? Which already will then create crowds of chorus of sort of wanker, intellectual wanker, all those. Yeah. What are you asking those questions for? They're not important.
Yeah.
But they're actually the fundamental question of being. Yeah. What does it mean to be a New Zealander with others?
Well, to add to that as well, I mean, a common occurrence everyone will know who's travelled is that New Zealand doesn't even exist because, as far as everyone's concerned, we're Australian. And I constantly, you know, have to remind people, no, you know, my ancestors passed through Australia. They were the guards on the convict ship, I'll have you know, but they weren't Australian. And this is an interesting place because it means we're sort of defining ourselves in relation to something else that we're not. And we're also not English. Though we do have some compatibility there on a cultural level. But coming back to this idea of manic depressive as a nation, a national character, I find this very interesting because what I had written down here is that, you know, it may, perhaps there's a sense of schizophrenia as well, and that this incredible complacency as one personality type that is, again, coupled with the ongoing radical reform, whether it was COVID lockdowns or, you know, neoliberal reforms that I think, I mean, you say we didn't go far enough. I think, though, from what I've studied, that it was quite a massive change, especially in the farming sector.
It was a massive change. When I say it didn't go far enough, I mean, we started something.
Going. Yeah.
And then we stopped. And we stalled. And we're not sure. And in many ways, we talk about being against neoliberalism, but we never got out of it. I mean, this is the interesting thing, that even though there are a lot of people out there saying, oh, we're against neoliberalism, we haven't managed to extract ourselves from it because our politics, we like the notion of agency. I mean, that's one thing. We like the name. I mean, we've got to remember too, I mean, Foucault liked Hayek's Why I'm Not a Conservative. He saw that as agency, as something new. And so on the one hand, we have this notion, I want to have agency. But at the other time, what we often find is that we like to be told what to do at the same time. Because if we're told what to do, it means we don't have to think about it. We like someone to say, well, this is actually what you should do. I want agency until it's a big question. And then you make the decision, you do what you do. And so we're stuck between those two things. And so we're not really sure as to where we need to go or what we want to do. I know what I want to do for myself, but on a bigger question, oh, it's your job. You do it. Until we find that in the end, well, I don't like what you do. And Pearson said, I mean, we like the strong leader until we don't. I mean, yes. And this is the interesting thing with the COVID lockdown. We were just so bloody compliant. That was the interesting thing until suddenly we weren't. I mean, and that was the interesting thing. We were very compliant. And then we went into open rebellion in many ways. Rather than being a mature response, it was either nothing or let's just have a huge sort of eruption of outrage rather than being a mature country and working a way through as to, well, how might we do this in a more sensible fashion than either or?
Well, with that as well, I mean, coming back to this, again, this kind of clinical psychology of a nation, the COVID example, most recent relevant example perhaps, but certainly it got bottled up, and it was really interesting for me as someone on the wrong side of that, as a heretic in the eyes of the state, that I think, you know, the compliance was overwhelmingly incredible. You know, it's a country that had never experienced totalitarianism or authoritarianism, and yet here they were, lockstep, single source of truth, all these memes that have come out of that period. And that was quite shocking for me, and in part has pushed me towards asking more of these questions about the humble New Zealanders who I thought were my brothers and sisters, and yet here they were actively avoiding me and reneging on me. And I think, again, as intellectuals, perhaps not maybe you more than me, but I mean, I feel like, you know, asking these questions and we're pushing things that people are not comfortable with. And that maybe belays, perhaps comes back to education. People aren't qualified with the reading of the history of political thought to know that what happened under the Labour government during COVID was a totalitarian thing that they actually pushed too far and they imprinted, you know, pushed into people's rights. But if you don't know that and you're scared, you're going to follow the leader. And
And I think it's a really interesting experience to look back on, because a couple of things are there. I mean, it's a bit like the rise of the question of free speech, which is now seen as primarily a hard right thing. But actually, I mean, the history of free speech came out of the left. I mean, the civil liberties in New Zealand, the Civil Liberties Union, arose against the waterfront restrictions in New Zealand, which most people don't know anything about, in 1951.
Oh, the strikes?
So,
was that?
Yeah, the strikes, yeah. That's where civil liberties really arose, because the government actions against the strikers.
They were bashing them over the head, right?
And you weren't allowed to give support to anybody striking, all these sorts of things. And so you had the rise of the Civil Liberties Union at that stage, because civil liberties, and that arose from the left. What is interesting is that now the rise of free speech is seen as a right-wing thing, when actually, I think it's a human rights thing. And I think this is where we're not really sure about human rights. We tend to say human rights occurs on the left or the right, rather than actually say, well, it should be questioning limitations on the rights of being human, whether it comes from the left or the right. And one of the challenges of talking about what happened in New Zealand over the COVID years is it's still incredibly raw and incredibly partisan. And so it's hard to have a proper, sensible discussion about it, because it was also part of a mass populism. And when you talk about the populism of Trump, but we had our own populism that was occurring at this stage. And nobody wants to think of Ardern as a populist leader, but she was. And that is what was actually happening over the COVID period, was a type of New Zealand populism that was occurring in the claim that this was of the best interest for the country, but there was very little debate. And it's very difficult to go back and talk about this now and in this country, because it's still seen as incredibly partisan. And the argument is, well, you want everybody to die. No, it wasn't about people to die, but we have to think about what it is we did and how we responded. And what did it mean to decide to treat people in different ways and exclude? And this is one of the interesting things, that the demand of in the public good. Now, we were not very good at being able to put that forward in a way that was able to bring people on board. It was very Manichaean. I mean, it became a battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. Probably too many people in New Zealand watch Star Wars. I don't know, something like that. This is
dark side. Yeah.
Yeah, the dark side. And so you've got this side over here who are wrong, and this is the side of the good and the great and the true and those who agree. Now, I got the COVID injection. Yeah, I wore a mask, but I could understand why people did not. And I think they had a right not to. And I think the locking down is... What it did is it broke a country that was already fraying. And we haven't recovered. I think as a society, we have long COVID. I think economically, we have long COVID. I think conceptually, we have long COVID. I think politically, we have long COVID. Educationally, we definitely have long COVID in this country, because we haven't actually recovered from that COVID lockdown and response in a way that many other countries have. And I think that is telling for us as a country. Why have we not recovered in ways other countries have? Why have we struggled? Why is it still such a raw topic in this country more than others? And a lot of that is because we went into it underprepared as a country to be able to live with each other. We were divided and fractured and fraying before we went in. And then suddenly there was a sort of a soft totalitarianism that emerged. And I know that saying this would put me offside with a lot of people, but it was very totalitarian. I mean, it was very totemic. Here's the totemic leader. Here is the pulpit of truth. Here is the roll call of the dead. Here is the warning of the sinner. These are the sinners either to save. We're going to save, and these people over here, well, they are the damned. Here's the calling out of the transgressor. I mean, it's incredibly religious. And that's what really fascinated me, as somebody who looks at the study of religion as well. I mean, it was an incredibly religious response in this country for a country that doesn't have religion, or says it doesn't have religion. Yeah. It was civil religion on steroids in that way.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. The manic depressive nature of the country, this moment, this crisis that we experienced, I do wonder whether ideas of clinical psychology could be invoked here, where is there not a kind of a counseling or a dialogue, a great discussion to be had, and perhaps, you know, we can think of, as a positive, that maybe from this crisis we could have that conversation. Because certainly one of the reasons I left the second time was because that long COVID that you describe of the economy, of the people, of the society, that was suffocating. And I come to Japan, I've just been to Hong Kong, you know, traveling around, you know, these countries that have got like real political issues and economic issues, but there's still like an air of like trying your best, moving forward, or I hate to say it, progress perhaps. And that's maybe an outside perspective, but compared to the intimacy that I knew, the way I intimately knew New Zealand, it just felt suffocating. And these people who I think who took the baptism of the COVID science to heart, and they really ran with that, I feel like a lot of them have broken. People that I know, friends, they've sort of, you know, their religion has proven to be false. And I'm reminded a lot, you might be familiar with Giorgio Agamben, who wrote extensively The Epidemic as Politics, and how, as you say, it had become religious, in particular in what is a relatively secular country such as New Zealand. We took it so seriously. And I do want to come back to this question of God, if it's okay, Mike, because you taught religious studies. Your PhD was on theology and church history. You're also interested in radical theology, which is interesting. But I wonder what your thoughts are on that relationship between Christianity, in particular, the formation of New Zealand identity, and perhaps how we have drifted from ideas of the church potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I even did the cartoon history of religion in New Zealand, which was looking at how we've dealt with it. For me, it comes back to this question of the nomos, the worldview. And that is the religious function of a society. I mean, as Durkheim says, a society and a religion, they reflect each other. What we've got in New Zealand is a society that is without a nomos, without a worldview to rest itself upon. I mean, that's one thing that Māoridom has. It's got a worldview. I mean, for Pākehā...
To Ao Māori, right?
Yeah, to Ao Māori. I mean, what's to Ao Pākehā? I mean... It's a serious question. I mean, because we had something, but we gave up the framework without thinking that's what's going to be the societal outcome. And I mean, the opposite of nomos, the lack of nomos, leads to anomie. And anomie, meaninglessness, nihilism, and as Durkheim says, I mean, the outcome of anomie in the end is suicide. It's that despair, that unhappiness. Now, I don't think we can go back. We're not going to go back to Christianity. But what we need is some worldview, that some story, some mythos, some cultural creation. I mean, the line between culture and religion is where do you draw the line? Where something stops being religious and starts being cultural again. But it's that thing, what are the stories we live within? I mean, and that was the interesting thing about COVID. It suddenly gave us a story to believe in. It gave us a myth, a language, a worldview to believe in, but it set us against each other. And then we lost faith. We had the sort of the collapse of faith. I mean, this is why Ardern left the country, because the
schism.
Nobody could believe in her again.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was the trouble, because we put all our hope, too many people believed in Ardern as the saviour figure. And politicians can never be our saviours. I mean, we know if we believe in, that's a sort of an idolatry that we actually have, when we want to believe that politicians will save us. What we do lack, though, is the meaning making that religion provides, which is ritual, meaning-making, history, tradition, community. I mean, what does religion do? Religare and religere. No, religare, religion binds us together. Religere, it enables us to reread existence, what it is. we leave religion behind, but we're not, but we also don't have a culture therefore to draw upon. I mean, culture can provide that religious response. I mean, it's what we were talking about at the start. I mean, that was that move of cultural nationalism, that move of the poets, the writers, the artists articulating being and meaning and place and story, but we don't have that either. We don't tend to engage with that. And so we're left unmoored. I mean, there's nothing to hold us steady. And so, in a sense, we lost our collective mind in an act of faith over COVID, which is really interesting how we did that. And then suddenly we crashed out of it and we don't know what to hold on to now. And we're not sure what to draw upon. And I think that is that religious question. And it is, we don't have a positive civil religiosity. We don't have that civil religion that we can participate in. I mean, Anzac Day is, well, we're trying to do it, but Anzac Day is about somewhere else and it's about a blood sacrifice. We have Waitangi Day, but Waitangi Day is always contested, and we're not, the foundation of Waitangi is contested in this country. So it's always going to be a civil religion that is disputatious rather than holds us together. And so then we're not really sure what to place our faith in, what to place our meaning in, what where do we stand to ground ourselves to interpret. I mean, what's the hermeneutic basis of a New Zealander? That might be the sort of the way we can think about it. Religions are hermeneutic. They help us interpret self and the world. What do we use to interpret being a New Zealander? Especially a Pākehā New Zealander. That's the big question.
You mentioned that you don't think Christianity will come back for New Zealand. And I am curious, I guess, of two things. Number one, what was the Christian origins of New Zealand in terms of the missionary work and a lot of that early stuff in your studies? But secondly, why do you think it isn't going to come back?
Well, two things. Okay, so the Christianity that came into New Zealand was evangelical Protestant plus also some Catholicism up in the north, came in with the missionaries. And then what we saw was the missionizing of Maori and a lot of the self-missionizing of Maori. I mean, a lot of the mission work, the conversion of Maori was by other Maori. Then you had this 19th century evangelical Protestant plus some Catholicism come in. But what we didn't want to do was import the disputes, the crisis of elsewhere. So the first day of the first parliament in New Zealand, 1854, the first debate was, should we open with prayer? Okay? And we had a variety of different faiths and no faiths in parliament. The argument was in the end, okay, maybe we should. But if we are going to, there is no religious group is going to have preference over any other. So New Zealand actually doesn't have a state religion. They went out and got the local Methodist after saying that he can come in and open it. But there is no state religion. New Zealand culturally might have been a Christian country, but in a political sense, there is no state religion. We continue that. And now we're diverse. We started to lose our engagement with religion very quickly from the 1960s into the 1980s. It really started to collapse because it wasn't seen as modern. It was seen as constricting, but it was also, we didn't really have an intellectual tradition or a cultural tradition to draw upon in the same way as up in the Northern Hemisphere. But Europe's undergone the same sort of transition out from Christianity in that way. Why won't it come back? Because it asks questions about institutions and authority and questions. The type of Christianity that might come back is culturally often quite conservative. And I think often then we look up at America and we say, well, you don't want to go down the American route. We don't want to go down that way. There is, however, a turn amongst those who are Generation Z, and I'm picking that up even amongst university students, And that's a turn to religion, Christianity, often as community. That's the interesting thing. It provides community and it provides a framework against the lives of what they see their parents had. So it might come back, but it's not going to come back across the country, but it will come back in certain cohorts. Oh. And it's coming back in certain groups rather than others. I mean, you never say never with religion, because religion always will come back in different ways. What we are in New Zealand is very New Age. And we've been a New Age country for well over 100 years in that way.
Yeah.
And that's a religion of the self.
Well, I want to share some thoughts on that, if you don't mind. So my journey leaving New Zealand and looking back on the role of Christianity and the Christianity of where I came from, certainly it wasn't a thing for me growing up. It didn't. It seemed kind of strange. It seemed, in a sense, it was this Plymouth Brethren, simplistic kind of church hall, in a small hall, and somewhere in Hawke's Bay. It didn't have, again, this intellectual trailings, which, unfortunately, if you take the intellectual trailings, you also take the political trailings and tailings. And that sort of speaks to this problematic of bringing in something from Europe, which has all these political situations attached to it. However, leaving New Zealand and looking back, I realized and I learned, to my great humblement, was that there is, in fact, something quite profound there that I had kind of missed in my ignorance. And it took me to the age of 33 to understand that. And to see that a lot of the issues that New Zealand faces, this preoccupation with the self, this fetish for property and for holding on to the material things, you know, that comes from a place of a lack of spiritual connection. It comes from a focus on the here and now. And I don't know, I haven't got any, you know, grand answers here or anything, but I look back and I think, wow, that's where I came from. I came from that place, that kind of deep-seated anxiety of being preoccupied with home and money and these kinds of things, even though there wasn't that much of it. And it took me to come here to Japan to have a few encounters to realize the power that exists within the Christian faith, and that has transformed my life. And just last week I was in Hong Kong and I visited an Anglican church for a Sunday service, and in my mind and my nostalgia for New Zealand, I wonder, are we not the country of the Church of England that has this kind of middle ground, this kind of normalcy? It's not quite all the way as Catholics, and it's not quite all the way as these American Protestants. It's just sort of straight down the middle. And there's something profound there that kind of brings everyone together. And again, I'm just throwing this stuff out there, Mike, but I feel there's something there that perhaps out of all of this malaise of COVID, the false religion of scientism, the false religion of materialism, of humanism, that maybe there is something there that we can rediscover, not at the expense of other religions, because of course there are many others in New Zealand as a multicultural place, but as the the great apostle Paul did, bring everyone together, no matter where you're from, and kind of connecting that and focusing on that idea of love and redemption. And again, it's big stuff, but I wonder whether that's not the way forward.
That's a big question.
The
majority church by default in New Zealand now is Catholicism. It's a Catholic country by default, primarily because the others have dropped substantially in the numbers who align with them. What you have is small pockets of religiosity in different parts of the country. I mean, what the Anglican Church offers people is connection, I mean, but like Catholicism, it offers a tradition, it offers ritual, it offers a history. I come from a Presbyterian background myself, and that's that intellectual Presbyterian background that comes through. It's seen primarily, however, now as counterculture. And I think that's an interesting part. Well, maybe the church should always be counterculture. Maybe one of the problems is when the church becomes mainstream culture. But the church is seen as out of step socially and politically, whereas the spiritual question that a church or a religion offers is one of what does it mean to exist? What does it mean to be? And I think that's the tension that we have. The institution of religion has become the focus rather than what does religion offer or act as in a social and cultural framework. I mean, this is Durkheim. I mean, so societies need religion to live. There's a social function. And the trouble for a country like New Zealand is you leave the religion that provided a social function. What provides that social function to hold a society together? I mean, we see this with the welfare state. I mean, the original welfare state was meant to be applied Christianity. That was the argument that was put forward for it. The welfare state today, it doesn't have that intellectual or spiritual or religious dimension to it. So therefore, why should I care about those who are not like me? Why should I care about those who are different to me, who seem to have not been as successful? Well, it's just bad choice. They are responsible for it, and I have no responsibility for them because all they want is my money. I mean, that seems to be the New Zealand way that we go through. Rather than actually thinking, well, what does it mean to have a notion that derives from the equal value of all people? Now, that's in a sense a religious question, but we don't want to think about it in that way. And so I think what you're getting to, Cody, is that question, what do we draw upon again? What's the basis that we can draw upon to articulate a different possibility? I mean, what religions do is say, how we are now is not as good as we can be. How we are, we can live in a different way. There is more than just what we experience here at the moment. There's also the story to live in. It's about a past and a present and an anticipated future. What we lack is, in a sense, being able to locate ourselves in that story, because how that story was played out in New Zealand was seen as limiting the possibility of being modern. And that's a challenge for us. So what you have then are the ones that are often on the rise are those that say, well, we can be semi-modern, but we're going to go back to the past. There's a nostalgia. And yet, this is the interesting thing, that religion is not nostalgic. Religion is anticipatory. But often the type of religion that has grown up in New Zealand over the last 30 years is a nostalgic religion, a time of loss. If we can just go back to the past and this is where we need to be, rather than let's anticipate a better future.
Yeah, well, coming back to this idea that the culture, you know, what is a lot of this stuff comes in from overseas, it seems far away. I do wonder, again, with my own story, you can look at the Gospels and think, well, you know, from a New Zealand perspective, they do certainly seem far away in time and space. And there's kind of a pragmatism that says maybe, you know, that's not as relevant for me, for example. And I wonder whether that figures into it. And I mean, certainly New Zealand has a strong Pentecostal movement. There's kind of, a simplicity, I think, a kind of a humble, endearing simplicity to that movement, that tradition. But I would wonder whether the nostalgia, though, of something like the Church of England has within it a connection back to the past. You have the artifacts and the images that go back and connect us back. And
it's a story to live with it.
Yeah.
That's what we lack. But it's a story that we live with and that then attempts to make sense of where we are now. And I think that is often what we've lost. Again, I mean, if you think about the historic connection between religion and culture, what we've broken that. I mean, in many ways, this is part of the cultural question. What does the culture draw upon to interpret where we are, and how does it articulate, and what is it trying to say? I mean, culture is that other side of religion that is about meaning making and expressing those questions about what it means to be human. And the big challenge I think we've got in this country is really, what does it mean that you're not just a commodity? You're not just a transaction. And how do we treat people as more than just commodities or transactions? How do we treat ourselves? How do we articulate what it means to be? But we're not philosophical in this country, as you know. As you say, you have to leave here to deal with those questions. But we're also not very theological. And theology and philosophy go together, but then also we're not very historical either. We don't like dealing with the history unless it's just a history that affirms us at a particular time. And so then we lack, it's not just a religious question, it's a philosophical question, it's a theological question, it's a cultural question of lack. And that's because we imported, but we never grounded.
A philosophy of deprivation.
Yeah.
Which against Heidegger.
Yeah. Yeah, we're deprived. Yeah, and I think that is where we are, because we brought stuff in, but we never grounded it.
Hmm.
And so when something's ungrounded, it's very easy for it to then wither. It's very easy for it to disappear. It's very easy to be removed. We're free of that, and then we look around and go, "Well, where are we?" It's what. The religious thinker, writer, Peter Berger called the sacred canopy. Now, in Medea, we don't have a sacred canopy, a nomos to live within. At the most, we might have a sacred veranda, but most people have sort of, we sort of say, well, here's your sacred umbrella. And it gets a bit tattered. And we don't give people the resources to make meaning out of. We don't give people the resources, the framework to draw upon in order to fully flourish, I would say. And I think that's the New Zealand problem, that it's a lack of flourishing, a lack of resourcing. We don't have enough to sink our roots into to be able to have a sense of, okay, how does the tree actually flourish? How does the plant flourish here?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, you do also quote, you reference the Abundance Manifesto, which talks a little bit about an agenda for growth, this kind of project too. Not because growth is an end, but because it is the best means to achieve the ends that we care about, more comfortable lives, the more power to do what we want, the more time devoted to what we love. And I do wonder sometimes whether New Zealand has another problem there, which is that it's not about comfort. You know, New Zealand, yeah, it's not that comfortable, but, you know, it's not too bad either. It's not too shabby. But it may be something deeper that's missing, and I'm reminded, man does not live by bread alone. And these questions, of course, of spirit do require some introspection and a deep look into one's soul.
I mean, what we want is we want a comfort for ourselves, but we're sort of, I'm buggered if they're going to get comfort and I don't get it. Or comfort for them, they haven't earned it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. We're not very good at living with and for other people. We live for ourselves, but we talk about the language of community, but we're not very good at living the language of community. We're not very good we're not very good at reciprocity. We're not very good at having the notion of a welfare state. Well, it's not very much, there's not much welfare going on. It's a society that is not willing to think often beyond itself, because I think in many ways we're Sartrean. Hell is other people in this country.
Well, it's interesting, again, rural New Zealand, my experience, it is a brutal place.
Yeah.
You know,
of
neighbors don't trust each other. People steal your stuff. There's conflict, disputes over land, over all sorts of things that I think is very interesting. It's like almost barbaric, and there is moments
it's
of beauty.
New Zealand Gothic, yeah.
I was about to say that. How did you know? New Zealand Gothic.
Because it's a common trope, the New Zealand Gothic that comes in. The thing is that New Zealand Gothic is in our towns too. It's in our cities. It's in our suburbs. It's not just a rural thing. We are that sort of New Zealand Gothic. There's that simmering violence and tension beneath everything in this country at this stage still.
Yeah,
because we're unsettled.
the violence against the self, the violence against others, the violence against the
violence
land.
Against nature.
Yeah. And that's what I mean, my kind of one of my closing points here, questions to you, Mike, is this countering the pessimistic outlook, perhaps, is that how can we look at the situation we have not with the eyes of the settler who deems that the great Kauri forest must be felled in the name of progress, but instead cultivated and nurtured. And perhaps it comes back to what you say, is a deeper look into ourselves, communication, dialogue, something New Zealand men are not particularly good at in general.
We're not good at that at all. And I think it's talking with each other, not at each other or past each other. It's also listening. It's also making the time and space to do the conversation. Think about the great New Zealand talkback. New Zealanders have this notion of talkback, but it's all about argument. It's all about, it's not actually about conversation. And I think we're not very good at facilitating, we talk past each other, or we're not very good at conversation when it gets beyond the surface. There's a fear of going deeper in this country, because if we go beneath the surface, then suddenly we're going to raise those questions that we have just sort of kept hidden. And that's the unsettledness of the country.
I wonder if there's something here we can learn from our Maori brothers and sisters, the concept of the wananga, the hui, of sitting around having a deep dialogue to make sense of the world, perhaps.
And taking time. I mean, Pākehā love to do things very quickly.
Get it done, man. Get to work.
And that's our trouble.
Sleeves up. All right, Mike. Well, that's incredible. Really appreciate you sharing your thoughts on this stuff, Mike. I am curious, just zooming out and getting back into this world of the profane and the practical. What's on your radar for this year? What are you working on? What's next for you?
What am I working on? I do a lot of work on a guy called Arthur Pryor. The philosopher and theologian. I've been working on him for about 20-odd years. I've got a project for the New Zealand History Conference, which is looking at old different narratives about different alternative histories. I'm looking at Alan Kernow's poetry, C.K. Stead's Voices, which came out in 1990, and Pocock together, so three different things coming together in that way. And I've got ongoing projects on New Zealand migration. I've got some stuff on cultural nationalism, and I'm trying to get a paper together for the sociology conference. It was the theme of a sociology of beauty and joy, and so I'm trying to think what a sociology of beauty might be when, but looking at it in social terms. So I'm reading Zadie Smith and Adam Hollinghurst on beauty and the line of beauty, and trying to work out, well, what would be a sociology of beauty? Is beauty a type of social capital, though? How might we make sense of that? And then there's all the other stuff, which is just the fun stuff, which is looking at, looking at still a big project, looking at New Zealand, that transition from 79 to 91 over neoliberalism, and thinking about what was really happening then. Most people have never gone back and wrestled with the sources and wrestled with what was actually happening. It's far more complex and far more fascinating than we actually really want to realise. We want a clear and clean story and move on, rather than say, actually, these things take time and we're not quite what we thought we were. And things didn't quite happen as we're told they were. And it's more nuanced. And I think that's the one thing I'm always trying to do. Find the little bits of nuance that we've passed over because they raise problematic questions.
Yes, that's fascinating. I look forward to some of that work, and in particular the idea of nuance. It sticks with me. You know, it's not a simple story. It's not simply the score of a rugby match. It's a deep, intimate story, because we know these people. New Zealand's a small place. You can go and, you know, he's an old man, but you could probably go and ring Roger Douglas up and have a chat and find out what was going through his mind. You know, it's not this abstracted layer of the political. It's right there down the road, and yet it's so. It's so powerful and encompasses our lives here. And look, Mike, just finally then, where can people find you? What's the best place you want to send them?
Just University of Canterbury. I mean, if anyone wants to contact, just my email, michael.grimshaw at canterbury.ac.nz. I'm also on LinkedIn. That's how we got there. And yes. I'm doing an ongoing sort of project of sort of public sociology.
I love your articles on LinkedIn. Yeah, they're very provocative.
Trying to post different things, trying to get a conversation. There's sort of like an informal sort of public sociology think tank. It seems to be going gangbusters some days, other days it's not, but some weeks I get 45,000 reads of things I've posted over the time, which is crazy. But it's trying to have a conversation outside the university, and I think that's the most important thing, because we get very insular in this place. I'm paid out of the public pocket. Why don't I try and communicate with people, have conversations with people, raise the sorts of things that I might be raising here out into the public realm and see what the impact is.
Yeah.
Ask the questions, frame it as questions and possibilities.
Yeah, it's an intervention, and I have a lot of respect for that. I think in the New Zealand media landscape, it's very hard to find people who are going as deep as you are. And LinkedIn seems to be a very accessible place. And I find it ironic that in the most profane of business social networking apps, you're able to posit these deep questions and kind of confront people, but not in a confronting way.
My wife who I was coming home and I was saying all these things, and she said, look, I know this stuff. She's got all these education, she works in these areas, and she said, why don't you go on LinkedIn, see what happens? And I took the notion of artistic practice, because I do some supervision over into fine arts, and that notion that my sociological practice, my academic intellectual practice, should be like a practice. So I try to have a regular practice of finding things, posting, like I sit on the bus in the morning and find stuff, or in the evenings. What am I interested in? Frame it as a question. How might we think about these things? Put it out there as a possibility with no expectation that people will necessarily read it or agree with everything. I don't expect people to agree with everything I say. God, it doesn't happen in my own family. On a good day, I rank above the cat. But it's about putting it out there as possibilities, because I think we need more conversation, and we need to expand the frame of how we can use it. And I see there are other people doing that on LinkedIn, which is a deeply subversive thing to do. And I quite like the subversive nature of it. It's good fun.
I wonder, just one final thing, Mike, this thinking boldly here and stepping outside of the bounds of what it's acceptable to do as a Kiwi, but is there something bigger here that we can do in terms of this conversation? Is there others out there who you've seen doing this? Is there a forum or a place where we can bring this conversation more broadly to the New Zealanders?
I'm not sure.
The big idea, you know?
Yeah, big ideas. I mean, this is what Substack is meant to be doing. And it was a New Zealander who helped set up Substack, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Hamish McKenzie, who came out of Critic down at Otago. The collapse of mainstream media in New Zealand is one of the great problems. The failure of Radio New Zealand to be the type of Radio New Zealand that I remember growing up with. And for a long time, it's become reduced. The collapse of mainstream television, news, debate, discussion, the listener as a collapsed vehicle for discussion. So I think we've just got to keep on doing what we're doing. As I think in many ways, we're into a new Middle Ages. We're into a new Dark Ages, actually, in many ways. And I mean that seriously. I think we're in a retreat from what the possibility of modernity could have been. And we've just got to hunker down, do what we can, create communities of conversation and interest, do what we can. It's like what you're doing here. I mean, here we are. You're in Japan. I'm down here in Christchurch. We had a really interesting conversation, and I've really enjoyed and appreciated it. And you'll now throw it out into the ether and see what happens. And give me the link. I'll post it on LinkedIn and see how many people have got the stamina to listen through some of it. But this is what I think we should be doing. Having the public conversations in different ways and just seeing what happens.
I love
change
it.
Change happens, and often in the most unexpected fashion.
Yeah.
I think that's what we need to go into.
That's incredible, Mike. So I really appreciate your time, and thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's been great fun, at least from my end anyway. Thank you.
Yeah, so on this end as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Cody.
I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.